I'm pleased to introduce now Professor William Kovacic to make an address. Professor Kovacic is professor at George Washington University Law School, where he is director of the Competition Law Center. He is also a non-executive director of the UK's Competition and Markets Authority. Before joining GW Law in 1999, he was an FTC commissioner. In 2009. He was an FTC commissioner, and he also served as chairman of the FTC from 2008 until 2009. Previously, Professor Kovacic was the FTC's general counsel. Professor Kovacic.
Thank you, Alden, and my great gratitude to my former colleagues at the FTC for the wonderful opportunity to participate in this program. The very holding of the program is part of a wonderful tradition that this agency has developed over time, and an indication of its recognition of its special institutional role in providing a foundation for thinking about the way ahead. In talking today, I'm going to give you my own views, not those of the Competition and Markets Authority in the United Kingdom, where I serve as a non-executive director. Today, I want to talk about what I think is an epidemic failure to understand the foundations of modern U.S. policy, to understand how that policy developed, and to understand what kinds of changes would be necessary in order to effectuate adjustments, a number of which I think would be quite appropriate. I'm going to talk a bit about where the consumer welfare standard came from, a bit about where some major principles that underpin substantive doctrine arose, and to talk about the need for institutional adjustments in order to facilitate changes. And in particular, I'm going to criticize what I think is an obsession with Chicago. That is, the sense that the University of Chicago, Bob Bork and others, in the 60s, 70s, hijacked U.S. antitrust policy and they haven't given it back. And to talk instead about what I think to be some of the deeper underlying sources of the system that we see today. 40 years ago, two prominent volumes about competition law appeared. One indeed written by Bob Bork, The Antitrust Paradox. I suspect most people in this room have read that. The other is Phil Arida's and Don Turner's first edition of their antitrust treatise called Antitrust Law. I don't know if many people in this room have read that volume. I'm going to suggest to you that that book has as much to say about where antitrust policy is today, how it developed, and how we have to think about changes in the future. Antitrust Paradox is quite famous, especially for its single-minded emphasis on consumer welfare, which Bob Bork basically defined in terms of allocative efficiency, perhaps approaching a total welfare standard. There's no question that that book was enormously influential, widely read, widely considered. I'm going to suggest to you that it only brought along part of the profession and the community. That is, if Bork's book alone had been the only source of insight, the changes could not have occurred in the way that they did. I'm going to suggest to you that Bork was able to bring the right center-right along in thinking about issues this way, but without Arida and Turner, we would have a much different system. What did Arida and Turner have to say in antitrust law? A couple of notable things. On goals in particular, they didn't speak about consumer welfare. They didn't speak about quite the same single-minded emphasis on efficiency. But they did say that competition law that does not embrace a fundamentally economic orientation and focus on microeconomic effects was badly misguided. They go through the egalitarian vision of competition law that appeared in the legislative history. They faithfully recite all the concerns about SMEs, about worker satisfaction, about small communities, about the protection of the democratic order. They conclude that discussion by saying, "Who cares? Ignore it." And why did they say ignore it? To do otherwise is to create a multi-goal framework without a weighting or hierarchy that leads you to idiosyncratic outcomes, judge by judge, agency by agency, which they described as on the border of unconstitutionality. In other words, they said the only practical way to apply this law in a coherent, meaningful way is to adopt a principally economic orientation and focus without using the specific term on consumer concerns. not just price, quality, of course, innovation, but Arita and Turner brought the center and the center left along with them. I'd suggest to you that at the time of my childhood and long after, who was the most famed lecturer in competition law? It was Phil Arita. Whose courses were the most influential? Whose articles carried thinking again and again? It was Arita and his collaboration with Don Turner. Why did this have so much importance? It was the emphasis on what they called administrability. That is the capacity of agencies and courts in the usual circumstance of contested facts, substantial amounts of information, to reach accurate and consistent conclusions about the legitimacy of behavior. And again, Arita would pose the question, you have to tell the business person what she cannot do in 20 words or less. It can't be a multi-factor test that is very diffuse. In many respects, that carried into their analysis of substantive principles. It wasn't just the goals. Where are the predation defaults that Joe was talking about set more than any one place? It's in Harvard. And if you go back to the 1975 Arita and Turner paper on predatory pricing, you see the essential ingredients of the modern U.S. approach to predation. Were they thinking in part about Chicago ideas? I suppose Phil Arita was notoriously ungenerous in acknowledging intellectual debts to others. He had very few footnotes that said this is where the thinking came from. But I think in many ways, the institutional perspective that they brought to bear on the topic was decisive. And their decisive influence was the standard has to be administrable, especially in a judicial system in which cases are tried before juries, generalist judges, where notions of intent, multi-factor tests are likely to lead you astray. And yes, indeed, Arita and Turner were confronted in a famous set of proceedings that this agency convened in 1979, 1980, a famous discussion of predation. I think lots of the tools Joe's been talking about were available nearly 40 years ago. Game theory, prominent in the literature. Behavioral features, not so labeled, but pre-existing in a matter of concern. And one author after another attacked the Arita-Turner formula and its price-cost test. And especially their observation that you take the low price today and you worry about tomorrow later on. What was Arita and Turner's answer? Are we concerned with dynamic effects? Of course. But we think they are, quote, speculative and indeterminate. And one author after another offered a basis for challenging it. But what stuck in the minds of judges in particular was the notion that the standard had to be relatively simple. Is that subject to change? In my mind on predation, have the courts, to use a regrettable American baseball analogy, have they shrunk the strike zone unacceptably? I think so. The Department of Justice and American Airlines ought not to be bounced out of court on a motion for summary judgment, where there's no jury trial and it's the government of the United States. That strike zone is too narrow. That should go to trial. That's worthy of fuller discussion. But if we ask ourselves, where did the emphasis on non-intervention standards in so many areas come from, and what we now call consumer welfare, where did that arise? It is as much Phil Arita and Don Turner as it is Bob Bork in Chicago. If you focus single-mindedly on Chicago and slaying the Chicago dragon, you don't make adjustments possible because you don't address these underlying concerns. If you want to adopt a broader goals framework, you will have to answer the challenge that these commentators offered, which says, show me how it's applied in a specific case. Show me the hierarchy of values. You want to give more emphasis to workers than you do on consumers. Consumers get lower prices, but workers get lower wages. What's the trade-off? What's the exchange rate between the efficiency that comes from scale economies and the limited opportunities for SMEs? If all you're saying is to tell the judge, you figure it out, that's an inadequate response. And I think to effectuate a change in the goal structure will require a lot of hard thinking to answer the basic question that Arita posed again and again when people would assail him on this. Tell me how it's going to work in practice. And don't just tell me that they'll sort it out in some way. So on goals, Administrability is a crucial consideration, and that view, by the way, has been adopted by many, not just those on the right, but a jurist like Steve Breyer, who said one sentence from Aretha and Turner is worth pages from anybody else. Steve Breyer is the perfect modern embodiment of that point of view, and if you cannot get his vote, my view was, when I had Alden's job in an earlier day, if we couldn't get his vote, hypothetically, we had no basis going ahead. What to do about this in light of what I suggest is the Chicago obsession and the remarkable forgetfulness about Phil Aretha and Don Turner? A couple of things. One, on the point of goals, in formulating a different goal structure, the administrability challenge must be met and has to be addressed head on. You don't get a richer goal structure unless you can explain the exchange rate and explain the hierarchy of values. What gets weighted, how much, in what case? I'm not suggesting that it can't be done. I'd simply suggest that in modern discussions and saying, well, the view is too cramped, it's not elaborate enough, it's not faithful to the original legislative history. Footnote, Aretha and Turner said, of course it's not. But the original legislative history vision can't be applied because it is not administrable. It's faintly unconstitutional. How do you beat that model? To answer that question, you have to come up with an administrable model. And I'm suggesting that there are lots of center and center-left judges and observers who've taken on that view about administrability. And unless you persuade them, you have no chance of moving the needle on goals. What about doctrine? Is it just the ideology? No, it comes back to this question of administrability. Is it just a blind faith in the market working, the equilibrium model that Joe offered? No, it's a matter of administrability. And what element of administrability in the predation case did Aretha and Turner care so much about? Private rights of action. In that famous first volume, which is a must read, they point out in stark terms that private rights, US style, are a menace. Mandatory trebling, one-way fee shifting, class actions, contingent fees. They said in the close abusive dominance case, that's going to over-deter. They said, well, you can't change trebling, that's in the statute, but what can you do, judges? You can change the doctrinal threshold. You can raise the bar, and we urge you to do that because the real danger here is over-deterrence, it is the false positives, so err on the side of raising the doctrinal bar. And that's what the courts do almost immediately after the publication in 1975 of the predatory pricing paper, and they've continued to do. And the predatory pricing paper foreshadowed everything, including recoupment. Courts took that on. Bork criticizes that article bitterly in the antitrust paradox. He says, it's a nice idea, but the right rule is no rule. And the rule that prevails today is the Aretha Turner rule, more than any other. Bork didn't win that argument. Much as Chicago won very few of the arguments on basic doctrinal principles, it's much closer to the Aretha Turner format than anyone else. If you want to change that doctrine, you have to do one of two things, I think. And I think I'm using an MRI instead of an X-ray. I think I have a better diagnosis of what limits the system there. You have to persuade courts that the private rights are not the menace that are suggested. That is, you have to amass evidence that suggests that's not the hurdle. Or you have to create a government-only cause of action. You have to insulate the government from the operation of doctrines that have been limited in order to preclude private treble damage actions. That's been a problem for the government because all of these limiting doctrines spill into the government's cases. When the FTC lost Rambus, what were featured in the DC Circuit's opinions as the decisive precedents working against the commission? They were all Supreme Court decisions in which a crucial policy foundation for the Supreme Court's decision was over-deterrence by private rights. They were all private cases. Footnote, when was the last time the US government was before the Supreme Court as a party? In a Section 2 case, that was 1973. All of the jurisprudence since then has taken place in the context of private cases in which the court's concerns about over-deterrence are magnified. So what cases got quoted back at the FTC? They were cases like DISCON, where the fear is over deterrence because of private rights. The FTC had exactly no success saying, we're the United States government. We are not seeking treble damages here. We want an injunction, equitable relief. Treat us differently. That carried exactly no weight. I'm not necessarily asking you to believe that the result that the D.C. Circuit achieved in Rambus was incorrect, though I think it is. I am asking you to note how striking it is that the doctrinal principles that the Commission tripped up on came in cases that were founded principally upon a concern about overdeterrence by private rights. So, you have to carve out a separate government-only cause of action. That could be Section 5. I think Section 5, more and more as I look at it, except for the little niche of invitations to collude, is too rigid, too fragile, and is not likely going to work. The FTC has tried to run up that hill so often, so many times. Doctrinally, it's not going to work. I would suggest an approach that prevails in the UK. That's the Competition and Markets Authority markets regime, which allows the CMA to do a study and in selected instances to achieve remedies in order to correct any competitive conditions. It's not tethered to the operation of European doctrine dealing with abusive dominance. Our system with this idea would not be tethered to existing limiting principles built into the Sherman Act or Clayton Act jurisprudence. That is, unless you create a mechanism that gives the government freedom in a policy space to meet more judgments, and yes, they'll have to persuade critical courts that they deserve the deference, that they're doing the good homework and are creating the basis for making the judgments, but to say in that space we do deserve your deference, and we have a mandate that is exclusively used by us. The UK does not seek divestiture in case after case, but they carried out a magnificent restructuring of the ownership of London area airports and others as a result of this. I think a markets regime for the US that allows the government, in this case the FTC, to operate without the overhang of the limiting concerns about overdeterrence by private rights is essential if Section 2 is going to work. What's the alternative? You're going to go case by case through the courts. I mean, look at Joe's agenda. Did you find that a bit breathtaking? Can you think of how many cases, rules, or other initiatives it would take to do that? That's a lot of hard work that will take a long time. Hard work that may be very much worthwhile. But behind each of those is a big case, and we know in this agency that building those cases effectively is like building an aircraft carrier. You don't turn them out in a day or a week. That will take a lot of effort. I'm suggesting that a way you can do that to go back to the courts and say, please change your mind on these issues, to slowly and gradually overcome the concerns with private rights. Or you change the framework to give the government a policy space in which it can operate, liberated from the constraints that have been imposed by the concerns with the operation of private rights of action. I'm not saying that the Supreme Court's perceptions about private rights are correct. I am saying with certainty they believe it. And it's not just the right side of the court. It's Steve Breyer. It's Ruth Ginsburg. It's a universally held suspicion. If you can't correct that, you can bring all the cases you want and you're running into a brick wall. Last thoughts. Changes in institutions. If you're going to take on a broader agenda, there are areas worth doing. I think the Commission itself realizes that. I'm a little concerned in Joe's talk that there's a sense that the agencies don't think about this. Of course they do. And they work hard on these issues. But I do think the U.S. is operating well inside the protection possibilities frontier with respect to its institutional framework. And there are a number of steps that would helpfully take it out to that frontier, one I've just mentioned. I'd like a markets regime in the U.S. First, to do all of these things will require, to take on Joe's agenda, a much better program by which the public agencies set strategy and choose priorities, not in isolation, but as a collaboration. We have no equivalent to the European Union's Economic Competition Network, which has become a very valuable device for not only coordination across the institutions, but more and more the formulation of strategy. We have no such thing. That's an embarrassment. We have nothing like the United Kingdom's United Kingdom Competition Network, which joins up regulators in sectoral areas with the Competition and Markets Authority. We have no network of that kind, and I've seen firsthand how the ECN and the UKCN add lots of value to policy integration and enable individual public officials and institutions to achieve collectively results that they cannot accomplish. If you want to take on the bigger agenda, you will have to do more with what you have. And this kind of network governance and cooperation can do it. Better setting of priorities, better setting of strategy to map out doctrine. Let's suppose we're going to carry out Joe's agenda. What do you do first? Which cases do you want first? Which rules? This will not just happen spontaneously. That requires a degree of integration and planning that doesn't exist now. It involves looking at past successes and past failures. Is the current concern with concentration unique? Go back to the early 70s and look at the literature that's just scalding about the failure of the U.S. system to deal with concentration. And the massive literature that develops in the late 50s onward, written by Don Turner and Carl Kazin, about the biggest failure of U.S. competition policies to deal with dominance and collective dominance. The concern has been there a long time. There have been instances in which the agencies have tried to take those issues on. It's worth studying what succeeded and what failed in great detail as a way of thinking what you do next. So better priority setting, better strategy, collective effort rather than individual effort. I'd say you can't start touching this agenda in a significant way unless you get more results out of what you have. Last thought. The FTC's unique array of capabilities. About 130 competition agencies in the world today. Half of them do something more than competition law. What's the single most popular additional element? It's consumer protection. And when I look around the world, the question is, in theory, everybody has a nice slide deck about how they can be tied together and how they're conceptually linked. How many actually do it in practice? That's more rare. But there's a lot of room for seeing what, for example, the ACCC in Australia, the CMA in the UK, which I've seen firsthand, the New Zealand Commerce Commission, and indeed the Competition Bureau in Canada have done. They're a lot farther ahead than their counterparts are, which have similarly situated portfolios, that is, this institution, in achieving a genuine integration. I think the FTC's capacity to bring to bear its three product lines, competition, consumer protection, and privacy, backed up with a robust capability to gather data and analyze it, gives it the capacity to do special things. Historically, that capacity has been difficult to realize in practice. That won't happen by accident or spontaneously. So in thinking about the changes, in a way, I'm talking about, one, how we have to think about more than Chicago. That's a distraction in key respects. Second, we can't just think about the physics, about what we'd like to do. We'd have to think about the engineering of how to get there. And great physics with bad engineering is a formula for failure. Thank you.